Welcome to Braden Avant. We are utterly delighted to have one of our favorite guests rejoin us on the show. Lionel Shriver has just written an outstandingly fun novel called Mania. And instead of asking Lionel to start with a thought experiment, I thought I'd ask her to tell us the premise of the novel.
It's set in the recent past, an alternative recent past, in 2011. And a book has been published that promotes the view that there is no such thing as variable human intelligence, that all people are equally smart, and any differences that we perceive are simply a problem of mental processing. And the book is subject to ridicule when it's first published, but within a few months, the thesis is taken as gospel. And therefore, discrimination against stupid people, and you can't use that word anymore, becomes the last great civil rights fight.
So I take it that this is an allegory or some sort of comparison to other egalitarian principles that a lot of leftists have adopted in recent years. You don't, as far as I can see, spell out the particular real life egalitarianism that you're targeting, but did you have particular egalitarian views in mind when you were writing this?
Well, of course, the left is consumed with the idea of equality and, of course, no longer equality of opportunity, but what they call equity. So that's equality of outcome. And I think the last frontier for the left is the natural world. That is, nature is unfair. And talents are unjustly distributed throughout the human population. So some of us have multiple talents. There are people who can sing and dance and are clever and they're beautiful. And then there are other people who really can't do anything. They're incompetent and they're not especially attractive and they can't do math. And is this fair? I mean, famously there's that short story by Kurt Vonnegut called Harrison Bergeron, which supposes a world in which all nature's unfairnesses are taken care of with handicapping, so that smart people have to wear headphones that interfere with their ability to think, and dancers have to wear weights in order to be as clumsy as everyone else. And while I've been accused of copying this story, obviously I'm aware of it. It's not that Mania doesn't have the same plot, and there is no handicapping or anything like that. But it's more a matter of just neglecting to acknowledge reality. And we have a lot of that lately. So we all know from a very early age that there are some people who are more on the ball than others. But in this world, in the world of the book, we are no longer supposed to notice these things anymore, that ideology trumps reality. And we're seeing a lot of that lately.
I'm very glad you referenced the Vonnegut story. And there's something about the Vonnegut story that requires an enormously powerful state to enforce the handicapping. It's a highly totalitarian society. You have to physically put weights on people. You have to be able to have the threat of punishment through death if you don't oblige by the handicapping. And what's clever about Mania is how subtle it is. There's a sense in which instead of actually handicapping people, we'll just pretend that everybody really is the same. The opening line of Harrison Bergeron is, it's the year 2085 and everybody is finally equal. And here we just go, let's pretend everybody's finally equal. And we'll enforce through another method this idea of equality, which is pretense and other kinds of sanctions. So if you buck the orthodoxy, it might not be that the stormtroopers are sent into your home, but your friends might no longer talk to you. Your university might sanction you or fire you. You might no longer be allowed to appear on mainstream media. What's interesting is it's quite hard at times to work out whether mania is a very good reductio ad absurdum for the other egalitarian stuff that's currently happening, or whether it's a simple documentary of what's already happening. The headline I read yesterday in South Africa was that a teacher had been fired for saying that her student was laughing like an idiot. And this is exactly the kind of thing that people would be sanctioned for in mania. Of course, teaching Dostoevsky as the idiot would be enough to get you fired there. But I've had a friend who was fired from her school for teaching To Kill a Mockingbird. So there's sort of parallels, run quite deep. I wonder about the other ways in which we're deluding ourselves about nature. So as you say, nature is unjust. People are not the same. They are not equal in their abilities. It's not that they're even given a variety of different things and everybody kind of winds up with the same amount of points when you add them up. Some people are extraordinarily strong, beautiful, and smart, and some people lack all of those things. Sometimes people do have different achievements and that's spread out, but you know, nature is partly a lottery and an unfair one, as is the rest of society. There's all sorts of ways in which people triumph and fail that isn't their fault, and some of which is their fault. But that denial of reality seems to be a consistent thing in certain quarters. And so how else do you think it manifests?
Well, certainly the obsession with transgenderism has a reality problem. This notion that trans women are women when they aren't. They aren't. They're men. And I think that one of the things that makes that issue so important is the fact that it is refusing to allow nature to have the last word, that we are what we say we are. And you can't believe your own eyes, and you can't believe biology. You have to believe the ideology. I also think it's manifested in the area of beauty recently, because it's been decided that there's nothing wrong with being fat. I'm afraid medical science would differ. But what's interesting is not just this insistence that it's perfect, you can be perfectly healthy and enormous, but also the insistence that being enormous is beautiful, and we're having this imposed on us. This is an effort that is doomed to failure, because you can't actually impose beauty standards. You can tell people that a woman of 400 pounds is beautiful. You can put the 400-pound woman in an advert, and we get the message. We understand that this is political in nature, but you can't force us to find that beautiful, because that's an interior response, and no amount of labeling can force people to be attracted to a form that they are not. And the left seems to think that their ideology is so powerful that they can overwhelm even our deep aesthetic responses.
It's a really interesting question whether those aesthetic responses are programmed in by society, which is what the left assumes, that dependent on our scripts and the way we depict people in the media, that determines our attractions, or whether it is some sort of biological innate response. I want to discuss an element of the book that's very interesting, where the allegory might break down. So in the book, there's this sort of devastating punishment of this idea of mental parity, that everyone should be considered just as clever, and people who think in a way that in the past would have been considered stupid are now just alternative processes. And the devastating consequences of that are that the wrong people are hired for the job. suddenly hospitals don't have surgeons or nurses or doctors that can do their jobs well and people die. Food is not produced correctly. There's contamination in food and everyone gets ill. Society starts to degrade because the wrong people are hired for the job. And you can see how that might be the consequence of certain forms of affirmative action, where you hire people into roles, not because they merit that position, but because of the color of their skin or because of their social status as being disadvantaged. But maybe when it comes to other forms of egalitarianism, and you mentioned, for example, trans, it's not clear how viewing trans women as women would result in the same sort of social degradation as affirmative action would. So I wonder whether the allegory holds up to other forms of sort of enforced natural egalitarianism, like issues around gender.
I mean, yes, I agree that transgenderism and affirmative action are not highly related, although there are plenty of organizations that now want to have at least token representation by trans people. So they are one of the now many categories that people will hire or admit to schools because of their identity, not because of their capabilities.
So I want to dig a bit deeper in this idea of how we're already doing what happens in mania through proxies. So the idea that we've abandoned merit as the primary criterion for law to prosper and instead prioritized identity. It seems that if we picked our doctors based on their height or their hair color or their eye color, that there would be necessarily a sacrifice involved, that you'd be, when you put your thumb on the lever, you're sacrificing something else instead of intelligence ability. So there's that concern. And in South Africa, what you often have is that those who require the support of the state, the poorest of the poor, wind up getting their resources from people who are deployed by the state, not on the basis of their ability, but on the basis of being prioritized by affirmative action policies. And not necessarily merely their race, but often their political affiliation. So if you're a member of the African National Congress, then you're much more likely to get a job, regardless of how good you are at doing that job. So it's quite well known that we have rolling blackouts, that I think the last couple of years, the majority of the days in the year have meant that there's not a continual running power, that we have a constant lack of water as well. If you're rich, you can deal with it. And that's what you find in mania, is that the well-off say, well, we'll import our goods. You know, American goods aren't to be trusted anymore, but we'll buy our stock from, from India or China, where they don't believe in these crazy things, and our food will still be good. And in South Africa, you know, I have solar panels on my roof, and my father has a borehole in his garden so that he can get clean water. If you're poor, you don't have that luxury. And it seems that there's that detrimental effect. On gender, I suppose, there's a different kind of trade-off. So it seems that there's a metaphysical question. Is it possible to change your sex? Can you move from sex A to sex B? And then there's a separate question as to whether we ought to pretend that you have changed your sex, and we ought to treat you as if you are a woman if you're a trans woman. And we might think that's context dependent. So if, for example, you're looking at competitive sports and you think that fairness is an important thing, well, it's going to be more difficult for cis women to compete against trans women in something like weightlifting. Maybe not the case in other sports. But you also might not think that fairness is the only criterion, that entertainment could be another one. We have lots of games where people set up their own rules. Peter Thiel, for example, has set up his own private version of the Olympics where you're not required to get drug tested. And so you can imagine a league that says, you know, we're a cis woman only league, and another league that says trans women and cis women can compete against each other. Sports is kind of a moral free zone, and you could decide. But there's other areas where there's going to be a trade-off. So, for example, in prisons, if your policy is you can self-identify your way into a women's prison, you're going to create perverse incentives. Not only people who are sincerely trans are going to want to go to those prisons. People with pernicious motives might do that. And of course, the Scottish realized this, and it's, you know, led to a crisis in leadership.
Well, yes. As a matter of fact, there has been a lot of opportunism, especially in the prison system, because the women's prisons are a little cushier. They're less dangerous. I think they're cleaner. less crowded, and also they have women in them, which for a lot of men is an attraction. So, you know, there have been multiple cases of men arrested for something and then immediately declaring themselves women and being tried as women, sometimes for rape. And in the UK police, you're supposed to record that as a rape by a woman. And this, you know, this is the kind of up your own arse reality or lack thereof that this movement is inviting. And one of the weird things about the women in sports, the trans women in sports, is that the left is usually so obsessed with fairness. And that's so transparently unfair. And it's also specifically unfair to women, a class of people that the left has also traditionally defended. And now they don't matter because their rights have been trounced by the ultimate sacred class of the transgender people. But then, you know, the left is rife with hypocrisy, and that's just one of them.
It seems like when you read Mania, you could read it in two ways. So the one way is almost like a science fiction novel where you've got an alternative history, you've got a dystopian society, and everything you've written is consistent within that world. And I really like the world building. I'm a science fiction author and I love world building, and I really enjoyed the way you built out that society. So you could read it that way, and then it's just a great read. I imagine where critics might take issue is in the allegory, where you say, okay, I'm not just constructing an interesting world, I'm making commentary on existing egalitarianism. And that's, I imagine, where critics have taken issue with your book. But there is an irony in that, of course, that the only reason they would take issue with that is if they saw a parallel. If they actually think that this bizarre world does match ours in some important way. So I'm curious about the nature of the criticism that's come out and how critics have gotten around that irony, how they've gotten around that problem by saying that this is a book that I don't like because it represents something in reality in an incorrect way, even though it never spells out that it's doing so.
A lot of the attacks on this book have been, frankly, ad hominem. It has to do with me and my politics, which I've been, perhaps to my commercial disadvantage, very public about, because I write a lot of journalism and I have a column in The Spectator, a magazine that itself would attract a sense of opprobrium for a lot of people on the left. So, I mean, in some ways, the reviewers who have been condemnatory have never got into the subtlety of what you're talking about. They just advertise that I wrote a nice article about Ron DeSantis once, and that's enough to turn off the readership that they are speaking to, and. So it's been frustrating not to have the book reviewed as literature in so many instances.
I mean, that in of itself is a phenomenon of, instead of engaging with the content of ideas and assessing things on the basis of their merit, we've moved towards other criterion, like looking at the identity of the person who says it. And so because you hold views that I don't like, that's a reason to trash a work of art. And seems like that's something that happens in literature generally, that the politics of the writer seem to be incredibly important, and that if you're a young writer, especially I think in young adult fiction or in sci-fi, you've got to publicly profess how much you care about social justice movements, and if you step out of line, you know, your career can be completely tanked. And I imagine it's very hard to be an author who's able to write what they like. And I think you're probably one of the few people who's so established in your career and so strident in what you believe that you comfortably do it. Although I imagine that there have been sacrifices.
There probably have been sacrifices. Many of them I'm not even aware of. I think it's mostly expressed in terms of invitations I do not get. And you never know what is out there that has been denied you because, you know, the email simply didn't arrive. And in general, I think I don't have that much to complain about. I have survived. I can still get my books into print. They're still reviewed. I do lots of podcasts. I do still do a fair number of appearances. So I think I've gotten off lightly. But I think, you know, what you were talking about earlier, it's been a problem for some time now that we no longer make a distinction between the art and the artists. And therefore, like during the Me Too movement, there were a lot of writers who were, canceled effectively because they kissed someone with dubious consent or put a hand on a knee. It had nothing to do with their work. And I've always been quite strict about this distinction. I don't care about the character of the authors of the books that I enjoy. I really don't. In fact, they could be axe murderers, and I'm fine with that as long as the book is good. But that has become a minority position. And the trouble with what has become the majority position is that it spreads instantly to the likes of the author's politics. It's not just a matter of the author's morality. It's also their beliefs. And, you know, if an author expressed support for Trump, for example, which, by the way, I don't support Trump, but let's suppose I did, that would be enough not to buy the book, not to read the book. And if you were given the book to review the book viciously. Because it makes perfect sense, because what you're actually reviewing is the author and whether you like the author and agree with everything the author thinks and believes that everything the author has ever done was praiseworthy. So that's where we are. It makes perfect sense that instead of reviewing my book, they're reviewing my politics.
That's very sad. I remember when I was studying English literature, there was this very big push towards reader theory. That was about 15 years ago. I'm really dating myself now. But yeah, it was about, 20 years ago. There was this big push towards reader theory, which is the view that the meaning of a work is determined by the reader's position. So whatever the reader thinks the work is about is in the material, so that the meaning that the reader gives the book is in the book. But it seems like we've moved away from reader theory even and used a reader theory of the author. It's like whatever the reader of a book thinks about the author is something true of the author, and we just skip the book altogether. We don't have to discuss the book.
Yeah, you almost don't need to review the book anymore. You just review the author, right? I don't like this person. This is what they've written that I disagree with outside of the book. It's not in the book. Never mind the book.
There's a wonderful moment in Mania where you're talking about the evolving politics, and you start your book in 2010. And so we have this alternative history and we compare with our real world. And someone like Barack Obama becomes very unpopular because of the way that he speaks. He's clearly very erudite, and this is seen as an alienating thing. So it's not just that we pretend that everybody is equally smart. We start to develop venomous thoughts about those that are actually smart. And we start to elevate people that are idiots. And so you then have Joe Biden taking over early. And Joe does a very good job of kind of bumbling his way through things and appointing poor people. And it causes international catastrophes. So some of the things that we find now, like Ukraine being invaded, happened much earlier in your book. And of course, the Americans are too busy navel gazing to do anything else. So course, the Chinese then take the opportunity to reclaim Formosa. And so the international effects are lovely. And then you have such a great line where you say, of course, not even Joe Biden, you know, could compete against the uber politician in this environment. And you don't say who it is until much later in the novel. But it becomes evident that it's Donald Trump.
Running as a Democrat.
Yeah. Which is also very sharp, right? Because Trump was a Democrat, right? And so when that party changes itself, you know, Trump becomes, well, this is a wonderful vehicle for me. And I think that's quite sharp. As you say, the difficulty with hitting everybody, you know, Biden and Trump included, is that Republicans and Democrats, you know, left and right, will give you a hard time.
I alienate everyone.
Yeah, which, by the way, that's our favorite kind of person to have on the show. And it's what we try and do, is ask everybody hard questions. And we think that that's good. It's important to sharpen everyone's sword, that just being a yes person for your team is very dangerous. And so, yeah, I thoroughly enjoyed that. I wonder about the other world building. The choice of the term mania, I thought, was very apt because of the way that it builds. It suddenly comes out of nowhere that this belief is there. And suddenly overnight, everybody seems to believe it and forgets that they used to believe something different. And then at some point in time, the bubble pops and people return to normality, or they overcorrect. And I wonder about that in our world as well, how we've suddenly accepted certain things as an absolute orthodoxy. If you deviate from it, you must be sanctioned and punished and, you know, driven out into oblivion. And then it's all over. If you think about something like the move to defund the police or abolish the police, this was without a doubt a mania that happened for, I don't know, about a year and a half in America. And then very quietly, people saw, you know, well, there's huge amounts of crime in my neighborhood suddenly. And, you know, the people in my city who thought this was a good idea suddenly think it's a terrible idea because they're, you know, having their cars broken into all the time. And so we'll quietly give the police more money and we'll hire more cops, and the mania ends.
Yes. In fact, we're going through something similar in relation to the COVID lockdowns, little by little. I mean, they are at least over, and that's partly why, of course, but our perspective is gradually starting to conform to the skeptic's perspective from the beginning. By the way, that would be me. I thought lockdowns were insane, and I came out and said so in March of 2020, which puts me pretty much ahead of the game. I think little by little, there's a larger acknowledgement that they were incredibly damaging, economically deadly, epidemiologically ineffective, and destructive of children's education in a way that is going to affect the rest of their lives. They were a catastrophe. And little by little, I think we are adopting to that perspective. Whereas when they were first instituted, I mean, one of the reasons that they came in is that people were clamoring for them. Politicians felt they didn't have any choice, or they did have a choice, but it was a popular thing to do, to force everyone to stay home. I think that we're also going through a gradual shift in relation to the transgenderism thing. It is now possible to say things in public that it wasn't before. I mean, I can just say, in answer to your question, no, it is not possible to change sex. Sex is written into every cell of your body. You can't change sex. But I'm not going to get my head cut off if I say that. And not that long ago, that was a very dangerous thing to say in public.
It is an interesting question how everyday people should respond to a mania, to this outbreak of a false idea. And I think that's one of the strengths of the novel, is that it really explores how the different characters deal with it. So you've got the protagonist who just thinks this is insane and just won't get on board, but is eventually silenced by her daughter, who threatens to take her to social services if she doesn't conform. And then you've got other characters who play a more pernicious role, who sort of are a public mouthpiece, but privately don't believe what is being said. And then you've got others who just have to go along with it and try as little as possible to have anything to do with it and just ignore what is going on as much as possible, but it infiltrates their lives anyway. What do you think the obligation of everyday people is when they hear false ideas that are suddenly widely believed? Do they have an obligation to stand up and fight it, even if it means risking their jobs, risking their social status, their friendships? Or do you think it's okay to sort of float along with it and then privately disagree?
I suppose morally it depends on what the mania is and how destructive it is. I'm tempted, of course, to say glibly that everyone has a responsibility to be true to their own perceptions and to stand up for what's right and for what's true. But that's a little too easy. And after all, we have been through countless manias. Some of them are still going on. And if you swim against the certain tides, you're going to lose your job. And there are a lot of people not in a position to be able to lose their jobs. They have families to support. They have mortgages. So it is requiring too much of most people to be courageous and to defend the truth in the midst of this stuff. And I am sympathetic with people who just want to keep their heads down and get on with their lives. They didn't come up with this stuff, and you know, this too shall pass. I'm even sympathetic with people who end up mouthing things they don't believe. I mean, there all this DEI stuff. You know, there are a lot of jobs now, and this includes academia, where you have to take these unconscious bias training courses and pass certain tests about, you know, what you're supposed to do in a given situation. And it's all in accordance with these very strict understandings of race and identity. And even if you think it's rubbish, you have to go along with it, because if you won't, you're out on your ear. And so you have to go along with it. And I have to say that even in mania, you know, my protagonist is very willful and does think that this whole premise is rubbish, and it is actively self-destructive as a consequence, and gets herself into trouble. But even she has moments where she completely backs down. You know, she mischievously assigns the idiot to her literature class, and they rat her out. And she's hauled before the dean of cognitive equality, and at first tries to defend herself, doesn't go anywhere, and eventually ends up crawling on her belly like a reptile, because she can't afford to lose her job. You know, she's got three kids. So even my heroine isn't a perfect defender of the truth. She also has to compromise. And in the classroom, you know, she compromises all the time. She has to pay lip service to the mental parody movement. So, I mean, that's the problem with these. When manias really take hold, there often is little choice but to at least passively cooperate.
I think there's some value in setting a lot of what happens at a university, and that it seems like students are particularly susceptible to buying into the mania. If I think about the mass protests happening on Ivy League campuses in America as we record this, it's a strange thing to think that students who, you know, 5-10 years ago, maybe even a year ago, would have given no thought to Israel or to Gaza, couldn't tell you which river, which sea, and have now passionately devoted themselves to this, to the point that they are going to sleep on campus, They're going to engage in physical altercations. They're going to hijack buildings. It's an interesting manifestation of this kind of mania that will die at some point. 10 years down the line, you know, these students will probably think of this as their sort of fond moments that's akin to 1968, how they fought the Vietnam War, but probably will play almost zero role in any kind of Middle East activism, that a lot of them are just useful idiots for, you know, very pernicious causes. The character, to my mind, that's the most fascinating in the novel is your protagonist's best friend, Emery. They grow up together, that Emery plays a protector for Pearson. Pearson comes from, I thought also an interesting parallel, a very strict Jehovah's Witness family who believe all sorts of weird and wonderful things that almost no one else believes. And then it's a very structured belief system that would require discipline, you know, and maybe even being thrown out if you don't abide by the beliefs. Obviously a good parallel for the other kinds of manias. But that Emery takes her in and they have this very close friendship and that they can joke about the mental parity movement until Emery works out that it's in her interest to parrot these ideas for a while. Can you tell us more about her and what you were thinking when you wrote it?
Well, one of the things that promotes trendy ideologies is desire to achieve status. And in mania, some of the first people to take the ball and run with it on the mental parity movement are the intellectuals. The really smart people who you would think would resist what potentially demotes them in the society. But instead, the smart people realize this is the future and this is a means by which to achieve still more status, even though the movement itself is clearly anti-intellectual. If you parrot its shibboleths, you're going to be more successful. And Emery perceives this pretty early on, that she has aspirations to become a television commentator, and this could be her ticket. And she's pretty good at parroting the truisms of the movement. In some ways, what's interesting to me about her is that that kind of opportunism makes a lot of sense. And she clearly goes through a period of maintaining a cognitive dissonance so that what she says at work and what she says in private are quite different. But I don't think that it's easy to maintain that kind of dissonance for very long. And I, you know, we often wonder whether all the wokesters really believe what they say. And I think the answer is most of them do, because even if you start out cynically repeating what you're supposed to in order to get ahead, it takes too much energy to maintain a Chinese wall through the middle of your own head. And eventually, in fact, I suspect in pretty short order, you believe what you say. It's just easier.
I think what's bizarre is how you can be going along in life and one day certain statements are perfectly fine, normal, socially accepted, considered true. And within weeks or months, those statements are not only considered to be false, but just unspeakably horrendous to utter in public.
That's what are you thinking?
I think a good example is when I used to lecture philosophy at my university. It was considered totally normal and traditional and something we would always do to teach logic, to teach Greek philosophy, to teach the greats, you know, the great philosophers that established the tradition in our courses. And overnight, there was this view that it just sort of arose. There was this view that, well, we're now teaching something that enforces oppression, that that destroys equality, that alienates students, and we need to, as much as possible, decolonize the syllabus, transform the syllabus, remove white male philosophers from our readings, and remove white male philosophers from our classrooms as teachers. And that was so fast. It was so fast. I taught for 7-8 years. It was not a problem for 6 years. And in the seventh year, suddenly, out of nowhere, there was this sudden issue that was spoken about as if it was just taken for granted, that this had always been the case and that we just didn't know about it, but it had always been true. And there was no possibility of even questioning the premises or arguing against it. And that was that.
Yeah, and yet it is flagrantly perverse to tell universities that they may not teach their own culture, that you may not transfer the knowledge about your own history and your own art to the next generation. And that is their purpose. That is their primary purpose of, you know, this, even the expression decolonizing the curriculum is perverse, because it is actually about colonizing the curriculum. It is replacing the curriculum of your own country with someone else's. And how universities bought into that and so easily is a real mystery. It's disturbing. And it involves field after field eviscerating itself and, you know, carving its guts out. This has been a consistent pattern now, that institutions in the West are turning against themselves and their own purpose. You have museums giving all their stuff away, right? They don't believe in museums anymore. And ultimately, the university doesn't believe in the university anymore. It's primary material, what it should be teaching, it has a stink on it now. You know, even traditional Western medicine is now being questioned as, you know, maybe we need to be passing on indigenous medicine. Well, no, thank you. Not for my upcoming surgery, please.
Well, you have South Africa to thank for some of these terrible ideas. So in 2015, at the University of Cape Town, the Fallist movement started, and we started tearing down statues. But there was also a famous video going around saying that science must fall because science is Western and colonial. And of course, the person saying this was looking at her iPhone at the same time. I found this very amusing, and so I thought I would make my own decolonized university. So it's called Saki Bartman University, named after the famous Khoisan South African. And we thoroughly decolonized all of it. So we have a law school where we took away all the Roman law, all the English law, all the African customary law as well, because it had been tainted by the colonial authorities. So actually there was nothing to learn at all. You could just print a degree certificate and you got that instantly. What's funny, of course, is that it, to my mind, struck me as such an obvious joke that no one would take it seriously. This page has thousands of followers who say, where do I sign up? This looks wonderful. So unfortunately, sometimes the parody fails. I did think about running this interview on the straight-faced idea that you've written the great social justice novel and you've pointed out the next frontier where we need to strive for equality, that we've done such a good job in all these other areas. And really, neurodiversity is just the next place. Mental parity is the next place. And I thought I wouldn't be able to keep a straight face for long enough doing it.
No, I don't think you're up to it. I hope you can live with that insult, but I don't think we would have been able to maintain it for an hour. No, what we're talking about, you know, I said earlier that it matters morally whether you decide to take a stand on this stuff as to what the consequences of the mania are, how destructive it is. And I've had to weigh this continually over the last 10 years. You know, how this whole bundle of manias, really, that we call woke, how important is it? How destructive is it? What is at stake? And because, you know, I'm a novelist and I should be able to be thinking about the big issues. And is this a big issue? Or is this a passing fad that won't even be studied historically? And I'm spending my time on something that is transitory, petty, and, you know, I'll be dead, and this is how I squandered my time. But I keep coming back to the feeling that actually this is pretty damn important, and that we're dealing with a force that is really purely destructive and at its core nihilistic and yet still very powerful. It has nothing to offer of a positive nature. It is all about carving the heart out of our civilization and just leaving it in ruins. And I don't think that's a small matter. I think the stakes are enormous. And, you know, I'm a part of Western civilization. I am actively grateful to my forebears, to all our forebears. And collectively, the West, I say this without shame, is responsible for some of the major advances of the human race. And on balance, has improved the world. And to see it destroy itself is horrific. And therefore, I think it's worth fighting the good fight. And it remains to be seen, because the vote's still out, whether this is something that will do nothing but gather steam. I think that's a mixed metaphor, gathering steam. That will get worse, and in some ways succeed, or it will die down, and we'll look back on it and think, well, you know, what was that? And I'm hoping for the latter, but I'm not so sure.
Do you think maybe it's difficult for people to know where to stand as these manias arise? Because you've talked about how wokeism is purely destructive. And as someone who lost their job at that university after sort of standing up against the decolonization, I am very sympathetic to your position. But at the same time, you've also spoken about the advancements that the West has brought to the world. You've spoken about the improvements in our lives that it has brought. And of course, before those improvements happened and before those advancements happened, there were changes in society which might have appeared to people at the time very much like the manias appear to the everyday person today. Any kind of significant change in our social beliefs can appear to be just abominable to the people who are around at the time and haven't thought much about their beliefs. So sometimes it can be quite hard to distinguish between progress and mania at any given point. Sometimes it's not that simple. Is it as simple as our forebears have come up with the perfect society and now we need to just stick to it? Or do you think there is some room for social improvement?
Well, I suppose there's always room for social improvement, but I mean, maybe part of the problem is that we got close enough to a workable society that wasn't horrifically unjust, that there's little enough to accomplish beyond just ripping it all apart and starting again. I mean, certainly in terms of these liberation movements for women, for minority races, for minority sexual practices, etc. We're coming up against a limit of how much more liberated we can get, and to the point where the move is now just to invert everything, and any group that has ever suffered any prejudice is now being given, you know, the right to actively discriminate against the people who as a group are regarded as historically having discriminated against them. That's not really a great, you know, I wouldn't call that making society better. It's just doing the same thing. It's actually staying in the same place. It's just a new prejudice. So, yeah, I mean, anything can always be a little bit better. But the people who get completely consumed with utopianism are historically very dangerous and tend toward totalitarianism. And in fact, that we talked about this at the beginning. That's what egalitarianism tends towards, especially this idea of so-called equity, that in order to achieve equality of outcome, you need a very heavy hand. And that ends up with the totalitarian state. And there are unquestionably totalitarian tendencies on the left right now, certainly authoritarian tendencies, which at the extreme becomes totalitarian.
The question Mark's about to ask is a great question, but it is a spoiler alert. It discusses the ending of the novel. So if you haven't read the novel yet, we recommend that you do so. It's a fantastic novel, and we recommend purchasing it as soon as possible. It's called Mania by Lionel Shriver. But if you have read the book, continue listening to this episode.
So the final part of your novel, the mania has died down. Everybody's realized that the mental parity movement was a terrible mistake and that it costs everyone enormous amounts in many ways. I mean, the way that they deal with the pandemic in your novel is incredibly lackluster. So many people die. You know, that America is hollowed out because of this terrible idea. You spell out the ramifications so well. But then you sort of hint at the next mania, which is this overcorrection. Can you tell us a bit about it and why you decided to end the novel in that way?
Of course, at the end, everyone comes to their senses. There is such a thing as intelligence, and meritocracy is a better way of running things than promoting the dumb people. But yes, it overcorrects, and so suddenly it is proposed in the U.S. that you have to have an IQ of over 115 in order to vote. And IQ becomes everything, to the point where your IQ is printed on your credit cards and on your tax returns. When people meet each other, they tell each other their IQs. And this is now not only socially acceptable, but it's almost required. And if you go on dating sites, you'll be matched with someone who has exactly the same IQ as you do. So this is, you know, this is basically another mania, and the pendulum swings in the other direction. And ironically, you know, my protagonist she was partially responsible in publishing a memoir called Mania. About her own experience during the mental parity movement that helped to overturn the mental parity movement. And then she finds herself at odds with this new obsession with a hierarchy of intelligence. And it, in fact, since everyone is forced to take IQ tests, she is also. And it turns out that she's not really that smart, as she's always maintained throughout the book, and everyone thinks she's being disingenuous. But what makes her a valuable person is not because she's so intellectually sharp. And she doesn't make the cutoff. It turns out her IQ is only 107, and therefore she's not going to be able to vote. Whereas, by the way, her friend Emery is much smarter, and clears 115 with plenty of points to spare. And you can tell that Emery is going to do very well in this new world. So in the big picture of the book, my protagonist doesn't end up benefiting that much from having had principles through the rest of the book. And Emery's opportunism and her adaptability is still, she's going to land on her feet. She's going to do fine. She distinguishes herself in both manias because she knows how to ride them.
There's a sense in which there's a golden mean between these two vicious worlds, which is to recognize that intelligence is incredibly important, but it's not the only value, that there are other ways in which you can contribute to society. And you say what makes Pearson admirable is her bravery, that there are these other kinds of attributes that make people important. And that once we start to prioritize some or delegitimize others, we make the world a much worse place. And there's that kind of monomania in both directions that's so dangerous. Are there other kinds of things that you think make our lives valuable? What are the things that we ought to be striving for? How would we be the best versions of ourselves? What virtue should we be trying to inculcate?
Well, my biggest problem with the left in terms of values is that all they seem to treasure is fairness, is justice. And I think that we have to remember that there are other qualities that are in competition. And justice is not necessarily at the very top. I mean, I place a high value on excellence and on competence, on functionality, and on qualities that don't necessarily have to do with morality, with a narrow understanding of good and bad, but qualities like beauty and humor, which I regard as rather outside this virtue versus evil. And there are relief as a consequence. They are, you know, like color. Color isn't good or bad. It's just color. And that's one of the things that makes color wonderful, or form of any kind. That there, you know, some beauty is subjective, but we also recognize that there are probably some universals having to do with a natural rhythm of a form, which is goodness of a kind, but not in that traditional moral sense. It's excellence. It's balance. It's a rightness rather than right. It is a yes, that's exactly it, or that is magnificent. You know, all these things are not to do with this rigid, judgmental, tight, boring, flat measure of good and bad that we seem to be stuck in. And that I desperately need out of from time to time. And, you know, I measure my own novels not in accordance with whether or not they make the world a better place. I have to honestly tell you, I do not care if I make the world a better place. Or at least the only way that I'm possibly going to make the world a better place is that I redeemed a few hours of someone's time and it was more fun to read my book than to stare at the wall. I measure my work in terms of to what degree a given book achieved its purpose, it realized itself, is in some ways excellent and whole. And that has nothing to do with convincing anyone of anything or making them rescue cats from trees or visit their grandmother in the hospital. I don't actually consider myself necessarily about a moral project, although I take on moral issues all the time. I mean, but it's material. it's material for building something that satisfies me. And I just want to stick up for qualities that just don't get much regard lately, even in art. Excellence is demoted. Art is being measured right now in accordance with political virtue. And I think that's ludicrous.
Even if it wasn't your primary goal, I was very entertained by the novel. There's a lot of deeply funny moments. And even though this is quite a serious project, it's serious in the sense that it's political commentary. You're discussing the pitfalls of egalitarianism and equality of outcome. This is a very funny piece of literature. There are parts where I struggle to not laugh out loud in public listening to the audiobook. I found it very, very funny. Specifically, there was a part of the book where the protagonist, Pearson, she's forced to go to classes to re-educate herself after her daughter overhears her using banned terms like idiot and stupid and talking about IQ. And just the enormous list of words that are now considered banned and irresponsible to use was deeply funny. And it wasn't just words that signify mental acuity. It was words that are synonyms of words, even in a different context, that might signify mental acuity. And so the list just proliferates. And it's a very funny experience to listen to that. And I think for listeners of this podcast, this is a deeply enjoyable novel to read.
Well, one of my primary purposes was to entertain. Absolutely. In fact, it always is. I don't think of literature as medicine. It's supposed to be fun. And there were lots of opportunities for playfulness. And one of those is that little section where she's taking this course in semantic sensitivity. Actually, I'm glad to hear you liked it because my UK editor wanted me to cut that whole chapter. She thought it was too broad, but it honestly, if you've ever taken a look at Stanford University's list of banned words, you realize it is impossible to be too broad. I mean, they wouldn't even let you use the word field, because if you said it to a Black person, they might be reminded of slavery. Look, I think most Black people would find that funny. They would. So, for example, one of my favorite lines is, one of the people in the class asks, well, can you use the word reflective? And the teacher says, absolutely not, because when you commend someone, one person, as being especially thoughtful, then that implies that there are other people who are not. And so definitely you can't use the word reflective. And she says, well, does that mean you can't use reflective tape? And it's just, so there's a lot of that, you know, just playing with language. And when I'm writing this stuff, I'm basically just trying to crack myself up.
Well, Lionel, it's been an absolute pleasure having you on the show. If you haven't bought Lionel's book yet, stop watching right now and go and order it from the link in the description below. We love having you on the show, and you really are just such a wonderful philosophical writer. And I think the good philosophical fiction takes a fun idea and then sketches out a world with that idea. And you built up such a fun, entertaining, and also dystopic world in Mania. And I think our listeners will really, really enjoy it.
Appreciate your imprimatur, and I'm delighted you both seem to have enjoyed the book, and I always love talking to you guys.
If you listen to this episode on Spotify, make sure to send us a voice note, tell us what you think about Lionel's book, and tell us what you think the current manias are.